Testament lesson. And I'm going to start with the beginning of that Old Testament reading, and I think I may point out a thing or two that you might have missed, or at least that's my hope today. We'll see if you had picked up on the same things, because my mind sort of gravitates to things that maybe, I don't know, not the average or normal or non-tangential person does. We begin with a word that was given to Moses. This was the word that God speaks to him, and he says, "This is what I want you to tell the Israelites. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." This is what we always gravitate to, right? The blessings, the incredible gift that God gives to the Israelites, because usually we like to come down on those idiots in the desert and all the stupid things that they did after God did so much for them, right? But what we blew right past is this. "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians." What did God do to the Egyptians? Nothing nice, right? He did some pretty nasty stuff to those Egyptians. So this is like the ultimate carrot and the stick, right? If you were, you know, the father who had just punished your brother for doing a similar kind of thing, you saw what I did to your brother when he went and did that. Now, and then the rest of the instruction. And I was really nice to you, though, right? In fact, I think this gets at a theme that has been sort of building through Exodus for some time that, again, unless somebody pointed it out to you, probably you've never noticed it before, because when we're introduced to it, it's really easy, this is the pot kind of calling the kettle black, to get distracted with a lot of other things that go on. We go way back to Exodus 2, and we see a story that, again, seems really familiar to us. I'm sure you've heard this before, maybe even seen it played out in the Ten Commandments or any of a number of other reproductions of the story of Moses and the Exodus itself. So we see early in Moses' life, one day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people, the Israelites. Remember, Moses was raised as an Egyptian. And he looked on their burdens and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And what we usually focus on with this, he looked this way and that, and what's he looking for? Potential witnesses, right? Anybody going to bust me if I did this? I don't see anybody, so it's cool to go and murder this guy. But I want to suggest to you something different. Because Moses could just as easily be looking around to see... Sorry, not there yet. That'll be confusing. Go back. This will be a point where Moses is looking left and looking right in order to see if there's anybody else that can administer justice in this situation. What he sees is one of his people being abused, right? And it's just as possible, instead of looking for potential witnesses, that he's looking around to see, is anybody going to do something about this? Some of us have been in situations where, you know, you're working under somebody for a long period of time. I can remember this happening in my own life. And somebody has a question, there's a problem, and you look this way and that to see, is somebody going to fix this? And you realize, holy cow, I'm the person who's supposed to fix this. There's nobody else around who can do it. That's a scary feeling in real life. And I would suggest to you that that is what Moses has experienced here. And when I talk about justice, what I'm talking about is that word strike. It was missed in most of our English translation. It says beating a Hebrew in your translation, probably. And he strikes an Egyptian in the same way. But it's in the Hebrew, this is the same exact word. That is nakah. It's a fun word. Want to try and say it? Nakah. Yeah, it's fun to say spitty kind of words, and you know, yeah, don't face your neighbor when you say it. Naha. This is strike. It's the same exact word, and I think that they use the same word. Moses, who probably wrote this, used the same word to demonstrate the justice involved. The Egyptian is striking a Hebrew, and so Moses, strikes the Egyptian. Tit for tat, the same, equal, you know, an eye for an eye. That kind of reciprocity of punishment. Moses went a little overboard, apparently, because he didn't know his own strength. He kills the Egyptian. He's not perfect, but in this case, and I think for the remainder of the book, Moses is going to be standing in the place of God. He is for the Hebrews and for the Egyptians alike. He will represent Yahweh. He doesn't say, let the Hebrews or the Israelites go. He says, let my people go, because God is going to appoint him to stand before Pharaoh, most powerful person in the world at that time, and say, let my people go, that they can go and worship me. He uses those words in the desert. Moses will stand in the very place of Yahweh. And so we see the next day when Moses went out, behold, now we have two Hebrews who are struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why did you strike your companion? And the guy answers, who made you a prince and a judge over us? This is what we call irony. Because who's going to make him a prince and a judge over him? God. He doesn't know that at this time. But then he asks this question. This is a huge question. Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? And Moses freaked out because, you know, word's out that he's done this thing. But this question, it looms large because, again, Moses is standing in the place of God for the remainder of this story of the Exodus. And so this question is bigger than just, do you mean to do to me what you did to that one Egyptian guy? This is a larger question of, okay, the Egyptians are misbehaving, so you're going to punish them. Do you mean to do to us what you have done to the Egyptians? You can see the Egyptians do evil. God punishes them with plagues. I mean, nasty plagues with all kinds of livestock being destroyed. The Nile turns to blood, gnats and frogs and boils, and the sun goes out, and then the death of all the firstborn. They chase the Israelites across the Red Sea that's dried up, and then what happens to them when they try? The whole Egyptian army drowns. There's some serious punishment that went on. Oh, and so by the way, what happens when the Hebrews do evil? Do you mean to kill us as you killed the Egyptians? So let's return back to that question that we had just a minute ago. And God's presented these two things to him. He says, you've seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings. And then he gives these instructions. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These, Moses, these are the words that you will speak to the people of Israel. This kind of is starting to have a different feel for it, isn't it? You talk about that carrot and the stick. If you will do all these things, you will be my treasured possession, for all the earth is mine. All the earth is mine to give. But guess what else that means? There ain't no place to hide. I marched into the strongest nation on the earth and humiliated the leader of these people. The Egyptians couldn't hide in Egypt. There's no place for you to run. No place for you to hide. I can do with you as I will. And so we see Moses does exactly what God says. And he brings that word to the people. He came and called all the elders of the people and set before them all the words that the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, wink, wink, all that Yahweh has spoken, we will do. Moses comes and tells God that that's how the people responded. I'm not big into making excuses for the Israelites, but what else would you expect them to say at this point? You know what God can do. You have seen what God can do. He's given you this choice. Do what I say, and I will give you this. Of course, they're going to say, we will do all that the Lord has commanded. I wonder sometimes if I put myself in that same situation. See, I was always a guy who would ask the question that maybe would be on everybody else's mind. Maybe everybody else was too smart to ask. But usually I'm the one who would give voice to those kinds of questions. And so I could see myself in the back of the crowd just raising my hand and saying, excuse me, Moses, but what if we don't? Just hypothetically, let's just say we don't necessarily obey everything that God had commanded. What then? What's God got in store for us if we don't? I'm not trying to cause trouble. You know, I don't want to be that guy bringing up that question, but I just got to know, what if we don't do all that God had commanded? Because I just noticed, this is before the Ten Commandments have actually been given to them. They've had some pretty simple instruction from this time. Go and gather manna. Do it every day of the week except for the Sabbath. Because on Friday, you're going to gather twice as much, and it'll stay, it'll keep. Don't try and keep stuff on these other days because it'll spoil. But make sure that you go and gather twice as much because there ain't going to be anything out there on the Sabbath. And what did people do? They did exactly what he told them not to do. People still went out on the Sabbath and go, oh, there's nothing there. And they tried to save stuff extra days and it spoiled just like he told them. They grumbled, they complained all the time. There's one of my favorite lines in all of the Bible where the Israelites go, what did you bring us out in the desert because there weren't enough graves in Egypt? You got to kill us out here? They're just always complaining and moaning about every little thing. And these are the guys who are going to go, we will do all. And the tally's going to get, or the stakes are going to get raised. It's going to get harder to obey what God has said. They haven't even been able to do it so far. And they go, yeah, we got this. But what if they don't? What's that penalty going to be? Well, I can skip to the end. Because we know the end of the story, right? They'll lose the land. Okay. I mean, that's bad, right? We want to be able to hold the land, but and the answer is apparently no. Even though they have done just as bad as the Egyptians have done, they don't get it. I think I did that. They will get the same punishment. But guess what? I was going to do my God voice. That's for later. You will still be my treasured possession. I almost wish somebody did ask that question. What if we don't? You won't get to keep the land, but you will still be my treasured possession. You will still be a nation of priests. You'll speak truth to the rest of the world. You will be blessed beyond measure. And even if you are scattered, which eventually will happen, all over the world, I will still treasure you and I will still love you as long as you stay in relationship with me. And I could draw a comparison. There's a really neat connection. We don't have time to really go into it, where Moses throws the blood of a sacrifice on the people. And because they're covered with the sacrifice, and because in a connected way, we are covered with the blood of Christ, we're forgiven. I mean, it's a neat connection. You just got to trust me on that. But I don't want to do it now because it would also kind of muddy the waters. And the real essence of the reason for all of this is because God loves you. Because God loved them. Because they were going to be His treasured possession regardless of what they did. And we are His treasured possession regardless of what we do. As long as we stay in relationship with Him, we get forgiven. His love never gives up. It never runs out. It's always there for us. Now, last week, I kind of left you with that, and I hope you enjoyed it, because this week I want to ask the next question. When you see a love that enormous, I think the next question is, well, what do we do with that? And we've been given something that is amazing, that is beyond our understanding, really. So what's our response to that? How are we supposed to act? What are we supposed to do next when given a love like that? And to answer that, I'd like to touch briefly on the New Testament lesson. I pared it down to just this verse, 36. Remember, it was read just a little while ago. When he, Jesus, saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. And that word, compassion, it's really, really inadequate. I mean, compassion. That's what we feel for something we see on the TV, right? I had compassion. But the word in the Greek, this is going to be one of those rare messages where I have a Greek word and a Hebrew word. It's splachitnomai. You want to try that one? No. All right, I don't blame you. This is why I start getting mixed feelings about Greek. The reason I have it up there is because the root word has to do with your guts, actually, it's grody, but your innards, your bowels. And what it's describing is this visceral feeling that Jesus has down in his guts as he sees people suffering. It physically hurts him. That's how he was affected by this. This is more than just compassion. Jesus is disturbed in his innards at what he sees. And how does he respond to that? I mean, we, again, can get distracted with the reading. He counts off 12 disciples and then he sends them out. Go fix this. But what I would tell you is what Jesus is actually doing is inviting them in to his compassion, his splachnitsumai. He's saying, feel for the people the way I feel for the people. Get on board with my concerns. I want you to make my compassion your compassion. And while he's saying that to the disciples, guess what? He's saying that to you as well. God has invited each and every one of us to share in that compassion with all the people around us. And that needs to be the beginning of all of our relationships, of all of our ministries. If we don't start there, there is no next step. Our compassion has to be the building block, and our compassion has to be built on that incomprehensible compassion that God has had for us. Because it ain't easy to have that kind of compassion for people that frankly don't deserve it, unless you recognize that God first had that compassion for you. That God is not this kind of father. God's the kind of father who gets you out from behind the bed, even though there's no way that you should have fallen for that right after your sister did. Over and over, he rescues us because he has that kind of compassion and that kind of love for us. I want to invite you, just as God has invited you, to join in based on his compassion for us, to remind ourselves of that daily, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And use that when it's not so easy to have that kind of compassion for others. That's a building block. I invite you also to stand, because I've got a responsive reading. I'd like you to speak the words from the heart that the Israelites were spoken or had spoken before. You're going to have the yellow. I'll get you started here. Lord. God responds, no, I love you. I will forgive you. I will appoint someone to speak words of forgiveness over you. I will also show you my love as my son suffers on the cross for you. also come to you in a meal. You will eat his body and drink his blood, and it will give you strength and reassurance of my forgiveness and love. And so it was. On the night in which he was betrayed,